Welcome to iNurse Radio, brought to you by the International Nurses Association.
Hello, and welcome once again to iNurse Radio, where we feature some of the world's top experts in the field of nursing to shed light on health-related topics that are important to all of us. My name is John Rivera. So glad you can make us part of your day. Today, we would like to welcome Roswyn Hakesley Brown to discuss her published work, Patients and Nurses, A Powerful Force. In this article, Brown focuses on the patient-nurse relationship and the quality of that partnership, and certainly how it has developed over time. This article specifically focuses on the similarities and differences between practices in the United Kingdom and the United States. This article also suggests that we may expect further development between nurse-patient interaction to achieve competency, compassionate care, strategic development, and a further developed operation within doctor offices and emergency rooms. Roswyn, thank you so much for joining us all the way from the UK today.
You're very welcome, John.
Lovely to have you. Roswyn, before we dive into questions about this transatlantic vision for future nurse-patient relation, let's first discuss your studies about nurses today. I know off-air we had discussed that relatively recently that you had retired, which congratulations to that. But from your experience, from your miles of experience, could you please discuss what the nurse experience is like today or in your final days in regards to certain powers that they have, be they clinical or informational, even political?
Well, from a UK perspective, there has been enormous developments in the last few years, which are dissimilar and at the same time similar to the US, but we're a little later in starting. For instance, in the article, we talk about the fact that the four countries in the UK at that particular time didn't have an all-graduate nursing profession. Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland did, but England is the bigger country with the larger population, and England didn't. And it's only just in recent times that England has actually fully come on board for all graduate nursing. So we can now claim in the UK that every nurse is prepared educationally and professionally up to graduate level. And this was something that I was personally involved in when I was president of the Royal College of Nursing here in the UK. We had a task force on education, and we lobbied considerably in favour of an all-graduate profession across the whole of the four countries. But of course, in the US, you have had an all-graduate profession really for a very long time, and a really well-developed, from what I understand, is a good career pathway in terms of a skills escalator for people to step on and off to achieve that graduateness, which is an absolutely splendid model, really.
Again, I couldn't agree more. You had mentioned to me as well that you did get a chance to spend some time in training here in the States. Have you noticed any similarities or specific differences in the values that incorporated with each of these patient-nurse interactions on either side of the pond?
Well, I think it definitely showed. I did a Florence Nightingale travel scholarship to look at advanced practice because at that time I developed a master's program in advanced practice, and clearly the US had the edge on the UK at that time with specialist practitioners and advanced practitioners, so it seemed to be quite important to see how that had developed in the US. And I was very impressed with the level of confidence that advanced practitioners and specialist nurses had in the way that they carried out their professional practice, in the sophistication of the delivery of therapeutic interventions, the way that they worked as a team with other healthcare professionals, and particularly with their medical partners, that sometimes they were used as the person of expertise, with other members, including doctors, going to talk to them, or the traffic would be in the opposite direction where they would want to discuss something, and they knew a woman or man who they could discuss that with as part of their team. And I was very impressed with that collaborative approach, and also the knowledge of the patients. And I guess that that might have something to do with the way that healthcare is funded, that patients do indeed have to pay for their care, and there's a consumer element to knowing what's going on and getting the most efficient and cost-effective and therapeutically effective kind of treatment. And of course, in this day and age, and the same thing is happening in the UK, people are much more electronically savvy than they have been in the past, even older people, and are able to get to grips with quite a lot of different kinds of information.
No, I couldn't agree more. Education has become so easily accessible for the patients.
Yes.
On the other side of the examination room, that you know, it's truly empowering, and obviously healthcare is continues to be a top concern for many people, really regardless of the type of society that you live in or where you happen to reside. Can you describe to our listeners about any differences that you've observed between healthcare on the patient side, now that you've put in some time on the other side of the waiting room, between the U.S. and the U.K.?
Well, I have to say, I would prefer to be sick in England than in New York. I remember being on holiday with some friends in New York, and we were at one of the Broadway shows, and one of our party actually fainted and didn't feel very well. And there was no one to help, and nobody took all that much interest. Now, in the UK, in a situation like that, we've got all sorts of people on duty who, in theatres and other public places, who are trained in first aid. They may belong to the St. John's Ambulance, and there's a general sort of pulling together to see what's going on and what's the next steps to be done. And I must say, before Christmas, I was actually taken very seriously ill, and we have to dial 999 for an ambulance, which my husband fortunately did, and I was a code red, and the paramedics came to my house within 5 minutes. They resuscitated me in our bathroom, including putting up intravenous fluids, doing an ECG, giving me oxygen, getting me well enough to move me to my bed, and then waiting some more time before I was well enough to be put into the ambulance and transported to hospital. All of this care was free at the point of need. There was no problems or interactions about, well, what are your insurers, you know, and where's your paperwork, and, you know, anything like that. And I have to say, when people are seriously ill in these kind of emergency situations, that is absolutely excellent. My care at accident and emergency was absolutely superb. I didn't get warded until 4:45 in the morning, but a lot of work had been done on me in the A&E department. And I was in hospital for just 2 days, where I was stabilised very effectively. And since then, my GP care with my general practitioner has been absolutely impeccable, as it always has been, in fact, but she's especially so now because there's something quite specific that she needs to watch over very carefully in view of these events. So that kind of experience to what it might be like for me if I were away on holiday, for example, in the US, and anything like that happened, I would be rather more worried about the financial aspects and my insurance than I am in the UK. And I think that's absolutely very important to understand those differences. And of course, one of the things, we're coming up to a general election soon in the United Kingdom, and health is at the top of the agenda. And there have been real fears in this country that we are moving towards a US style of funding for healthcare here, which is of huge concern to many patients, and I think to a lot of the professionals too.
I'd imagine so, certainly. So you've been clear in that you'd prefer to be a patient in the UK as opposed to the US. What about performing then as a medical professional? Would you prefer one side or the other?
I'm not sure about the also, let's not pretend, being very hard for professionals in the UK at the moment because of the funding situation. And there have been, as you're probably aware, a number of disasters, events that should never have happened. I live in the West Midlands, and Mid-Staffs Hospital isn't far from where I live. I was a chair of a patient's organisation, and we had a research project with this particular hospital foundation to look at the way that they managed complaints. And that was a very interesting experience. So I don't think there's any room to be complacent in the UK about healthcare, and I think there are constant struggles to balance the books and for the healthcare professionals to deliver the kind of service that they would want to deliver under the current constraints. Now, I don't know whether there are similar workforce considerations in the United States, given the different funding model, that possibly there isn't quite the level of pressure that is going on in the US as there is in the UK in relation to being able to complete the work satisfactorily. And that is why I think it's really important to look at the patient part of the dyad, because the King's Fund in the UK, which is a really excellent think tank in relation to healthcare, did a report in 2011 when the new government had introduced this idea of no decision about me without me in relation to involving patients in the negotiations for healthcare. And the King's Fund report pointed out that in the UK, we were still the most paternalistic healthcare system in Europe. And that kind of system isn't terribly helpful if the patient isn't considered to be an active partner in both negotiating their care, co-creating the systems that provide the care, being part of the co-production of that care event, so that they can contribute very effectively and probably bring down the cost of care in relation to the healthcare economics of the situation. And of course, this kind of model is incredibly useful in relation to public health issues, for example, smoking cessation. And we have in this country at the moment a big controversy going on that erupted over the Christmas period because accident and emergency departments have been under great pressure with a lot of patient footfall through them, which has been exacerbated over the festive season by people with alcohol-related conditions. Clearly people have some influence about what their intake is and how they behave.
That's right.
And just feel that they can call an ambulance if they can't get a cab home.
Truly,
and
that's
so
it's a bit misplaced.
Well, clearly. And one of the things that I've argued as a sort of patient advocate individual is that patients do have rights, but they also have responsibilities. And I think we need to focus on both of those areas equally in terms of utilising the skills and input of patients and their compliance, if you like, in relation to what is best for their health and what they can do to actually contribute to maintaining a healthy lifestyle that isn't a cost on the healthcare system that they're currently situated in.
Well, that's certainly, I don't think anyone could disagree there. Just to give a bit of perspective from this side, two concerns in the United States, amongst many others, unfortunately, but two specific would be wait room time and cost to visit a doctor. And I can speak from experience here in the New York area where we record. Research results reveal that on average, a patient will have a 35-minute wait time before they receive an examination from a doctor before they're seen, and approximately 156-minute or give or take 2.5-hour wait from the time they arrive until the time they are sent home. This clearly is influenced on the injury or the nature of the visit. But can you describe what you've observed in regards to wait time at hospitals in the UK? You were just speaking of this past experience that you just had.
Well, the wait time for the emergency services to arrive at my home was 5 minutes. Getting me to hospital took place as soon as I was fit enough to actually travel. Being seen in the A&E department, I think I was seen within half an hour, possibly 15 minutes. It didn't seem to be very long. I was there waiting for a bed, but things were being carried out in relation to the interventions that needed to be done.
In the
interim. Wasted time. But of course, this can be very variable in relation to the footfall through these kind of departments. My general practitioner, there's a wait usually of about 20 minutes at the most to see a general practitioner, but my GP doesn't always keep to the allocated ration time for each consultation. If she needs to spend more time with the patient, she will do so. And I think that is actually a plus, and everyone understands about that.
For sure. Well said. And as we mentioned earlier, cost, of course, is a huge concern for many people.
Absolutely.
Do you feel that the cost of going to the ER or even a standard regular doctor's office has an influence on the nurse-patient experience from a nurse side of the table?
Well, the nurses who work with general practice in the UK do work in partnership with the doctor, and there is not a cost element that enters into that particular transaction. But it may well be part of the thinking in relation to transactions in the US. For example, some patients, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, may be quite reluctant to seek advice until it becomes absolutely necessary, by which time their condition may have deteriorated significantly.
Sadly, that's very, very accurate.
Yeah, made me more difficult to deal with from a professional perspective. We all like success, don't we? And quick fixes for what we do. And if you're not able to do that, it becomes very frustrating. And you know you could have done it if that hadn't been the case.
Absolutely, absolutely. One other interesting topic that you mentioned in the article is diversity amongst nurses in the U.S. and the U.K. You don't just suggest that there's a difference, but that there rather is a significant difference between the two countries. Can you discuss some of the statistics, perhaps, that you had discovered at that time?
Well, obviously, Beverly Malone and I found this very interesting in terms of her experience having worked, first of all, obviously, in the US and then moved over to the UK and as an Afro-Caribbean woman or Afro-American woman, I think probably Beverly describes herself as. It is significantly different. I think there are more, historically, there's been a rather more painful journey in the US in relation to diversity issues, particularly in terms of race. I mean, diversity covers a lot of different aspects, but I'm referring particularly to race at the moment. I think that's a particularly good example. And there seems to me to be a much more sophisticated infrastructure in relation to the legislative framework, for example, that are in place, that they have been done much earlier and are much more bedded in than they have been in the UK. And that might be because the UK is smaller, but it is very culturally diverse. I've done a lot of work with refugee healthcare professionals, and I know what the issues have been in relation to them and how difficult it's been in terms of actually moving through the system, becoming legitimate practitioners in the UK so that they can actually work in their chosen professions. I have been known to take a minibus load of refugee nurses to the regulatory body in London to see how they were greeted and dealt with, and it was quite a salutary experience. And as a past researcher, I wrote up my field notes and then went to see chief executive and said, look, this is what it was like, the lived experience of refugee nurses coming to this organization. And there were some quite significant steps taken to improve that scenario. I have to say, out there as a patient or as a member of the public, my name is Mrs. Brown, and it's a good name to achieve some anonymity. I never tell people my background or who I am. You might think that's a bit unfair, but I want to get the same kind of care that everybody else gets, or be treated with the same level of respect as everybody else. And if that doesn't happen, then I can actually say something about that. I've got the confidence and the knowledge to do something about it. So it's quite an interesting position to be in and an interesting name to have. But we've just got, and Beverly would be interested in this, our first black president of the Royal College of Nursing, which I have to say I'm very thrilled about.
I'd say. That's truly wonderful.
It is.
Rosalind, you speak about a transatlantic vision for the future of nursing. And, of course, as we all know, the field is constantly evolving with new protocols and technology, available equipment and so forth. Can you give us your input on what you believe will be the largest influence in regards to change within the nursing profession in the future?
I think the biggest area of change is something that I've already hinted at, and it's with varying degrees according to the country that you're considering. Is this patient-nurse partnership and the nature of that partnership and how it actually works. Some people really find it very difficult, both from a patient perspective and from a professional perspective, to work in an equal partnership. And it's very important to acknowledge what those reservations are and be able to do something about those areas of perhaps weakness. One of the drums that I constantly bang in my UK work is that this area does need some investment in terms of giving both professionals and patients the right toolkit to be able to operate in a really effective 50-50 partnership. And it doesn't happen in a vacuum. It has to be actively introduced and taken part in. And bringing that kind of vision into reality, I think, could be a really important step in terms of mutual respect of what each other is actually doing and what each other's contribution is to the healthcare endeavor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Very well stated. With your experience, all of your experience, observations, with your research, clearly you're very well positioned to state fact. What would you say that you believe has been the most powerful, the most effective nurse practice in terms of improving those type of relationships between nurses and patients?
There have been a number of initiatives in relation to introducing individualized care rather than splitting patients up into tasks to be done. We've still got a long way to go seeing patients as, you know, sort of holistic individuals. And I must say the medics have a lot to answer for here. I get very frustrated when the person who looks after my thyroid cancer doesn't want to know anything about my cardiac condition. And
of course,
each of us body systems, you know, is put in a little box, and there's no relationship between what goes on in one area and what is going on in another. So it's not just about the medical reductionism that goes on. It's about seeing the whole person and being able to work with that whole person. And so introducing the notion of, and emphasizing the notion of individualized care, I think, is a crucial step in that direction. And the more healthcare professionals who can be positive role models in that respect, then the sooner we will get to this kind of nirvana that I'm looking for.
Outstanding, outstanding answer, Roswyn. Unfortunately, we are indeed just about out of time, but you've certainly given us so much good, good information. Thank you for joining us and certainly for being such a wonderful guest.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, of course. Anytime. Anytime whatsoever, Roswyn. And thanks, of course, to the listeners as well. So until next time, this is John Rivera for iNurse Radio.